is No Filter Sports today, October 29th, 2020. Eli Zarrett, Bob Page, Denny McClain. And gentlemen, you talked at length about the World Series. Bob had said that Game 4 was the most exciting of all time. You guys pushed back a little bit on that.
Game 4, I just said that Game 4 was the single greatest baseball game I personally had ever seen. Denny and Larry Sorensen didn't necessarily agree with me or necessarily disagree. Brandon agreed with me.
Well, the reason I disagree...
Well, you messed it up, Eli, because you didn't watch it start to finish as we did. You were going in and out. You rejoined it the next morning,
That's because I didn't have to watch 25 sporting events last week because I didn't do the show on Monday. Instead of watching 25 games, I only watched 22, and I did watch the new Borat movie because I could at least get my eyeballs off sports for a moment. That being said, I disagree that it's the greatest game of all time because there's been so many, it's hard to pick one.
Yes, that's true.
Our guest today, by the way, is Todd Stottlemyre. And as I was researching him, he had a remarkable career, the son of Mel, who Denny pitched against. We'll talk about that a lot. But in a very notorious game for him, the one where he slid and chopped his chin up, that game was 15-14 against the Phillies, an incredible seesaw affair that set records right and left. And at the time, you know what they said about that game? It was the greatest World Series game ever played. So with all due respect, because it was a great game, Bob, no arguments there. There have been many, and you can make that.
I know what you're saying. I'm repeating. Personally, I just thought it was the greatest game I've ever seen.
I thought one of the greatest series was it the Mets in the late 80s? 85?
When Buckner made
86?
The ball went through Buckner's legs.
I covered that too.
I thought that was a hell of a series.
Well, and then the Reds and the Red Sox, you know? I mean, that was an amazing World Series too. I mean, there've been a lot of them. I'm not saying this is the greatest World Series ever. Again, just one game, the greatest I ever saw.
And by the way, the Fox color analyst, John Smoltz, pitched in a pretty good one that went 10 innings, and Jack Morris went all 10 innings, and that was pretty exciting. So I don't know. Was that the greatest of all time? Guess what they said at the time? Was this the greatest low-scoring game?
I know what you're saying. By the way, as much as we love Smoltz, a former guest on this show, is he getting paid by the word to broadcast the World Series?
He's very chatty. He's very...
Does he ever stop?
No, it's unbelievable.
I think
he's got everybody trying to learn how to throw a little slider, a curveball, a changeup. Now, this is what happens when you throw it this way. I mean, I just could not believe what was coming out of his mouth. And half of it made no sense at all.
You know, there is.
I do like some of the stories, though, Denny. Stories are different. So at one point in the game, as you saw the other night, there was a ground ball in the infield, and the ball, you know, got a scuff mark on it. And Smoltz goes into this thing about, God, I love it when a ball had a little scuff mark. I just kept it. I got six straight guys. And finally, Chipper Jones picked it up and he threw it into the stands. So I said, what the hell are you doing? I want that ball back. Denny, did you feel that way?
I never wanted a new ball. I seldom ever rubbed up a ball, but I would go out of my way to keep the ball in the game. And if we could keep a ball in the game for 8 or 9, 10 pitches, the ball gets a little loose. The covering of the ball, the leather.
And, with nine pitches? Wow.
Nine or 10 pitches. Because I'm talking about a foul ball or two. So what happens, like, you know, ground ball foul down the first baseline to third baseline, whatever. And it makes a big difference, boy, if you know what to do when the ball comes back to you and it's got some scuff marks on it. It's a gift from God.
I think they throw balls out a lot faster than they used to. But any time they pitch in the dirt, they throw.
They seem to. That's a good point. They seem to, don't they? And how about another statement?
But they do because it's a league rule. Anytime a ball is used, they throw it away right away now.
Well, how do you define used? What do you mean?
Well, very seldom will you ever see a ball stay in a game for more than a couple, 2-3 pitches now.
Yeah, and if it's ever hit, you know, if it goes
out of the game.
But by the way, let me
interrupt you on this, Denny. Let me ask you this: is this a residual effect of, let's say, Gaylord Perry? And do they throw it out this quickly now because they want to make sure nobody's loading up?
No, what it's all about right now is just the COVID. The COVID has got something to do with this. No, with touching the ball, giving the ball to the other guy, that type of stuff.
No, but this has been going on for the last 10 years. I think it started not like this.
At two and three pitches, they're throwing the ball away.
But you'll never see a ball bounce foul, get dirt on it, and stay in the game like it did back in your day. But back to Smoltz and the over-analysis of pitching. I will say I love when Jack Morris or John Smoltz or others, the art of pitching is fascinating to all of us. It truly is. It's what baseball is all about. The pitcher has the ball on every moment of the game, every play of the game. And the subtleties of it are fascinating. And when we were kids, you never heard about four seamers, two seamers, cutters, you know, different types of change ups. So, you know, this kind of slider and that slider. So it's
How about this? How about positivity?
It's not even a word.
That's negativity. I mean, it's unbelievable where they keep coming up with these terms.
Yeah, you know, Eli, I was talking with our old mutual friend, and I do mean old. Well, I think he's 93 now, 94, Bob Miller, the hard throw off the Detroit Sandlots. Yeah. Booger, you know, pitched with the Phillies throughout the entire 1950s, started game four of the 1951
series. By the way, you've mentioned him on a show about 20 or 30 times, but that's okay. We all know about Bob Miller. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know that we all do, and not everybody listens to every show, and we have a lot of younger people like Brandon listening. But anyway, I said the same thing to Bob a few years ago. He said, we never called it that. If you grip the fastball one way, it would rise. If you grip the fastball another way, it would sink. That's all.
More or less, that's true.
Well, pitching after game six, which the Dodgers won to win the World Series, has been the story, an incredible story, how Blake Snell, to the shock of everyone watching, and I tell you, Kevin Cash will be haunted for life by this decision. And what it brought to bear is the great divide, right? Old versus new, today versus, the way it was in the past, where numbers, algorithms, hidden factors on spreadsheets inform all these decisions, as opposed to what you see happening. And everybody in America had the same reaction from the broadcast booth on down. No, you can't take him out. It's the top of the six. It's his game. He's in complete command. He's dominant. What are you doing? And yet he did. And the reaction when Nick Anderson came into the next six pitches, the game was effectively over. So before we play what I have Snell said and what Cash said and what Joe Buck said.
I haven't even listened to what Cash said, Eli. I haven't read a quote he made because I don't give a you know what he said. There's no excuse for it.
Here's how it's
said. No, I agree. I totally agree. It's 100%. He should have never come out of that game. The guy has pitched 5 1/3 innings. He is in total command. He's hitting the glove 9 out of 10 times. His breaking ball was terrific. Somebody said, I think it was in the papers this morning, it's the first time they'd ever seen him have command of all four pitches. And he had it the other night. He had it all. And you know, my point was, when Cash came out, you have to make a decision, and I think he already had, whether you are going to manage that team based upon, what do you call it? The
percentages, the silver metrics.
You're going to manage that way. Or are you going to manage by playing the game the right way? So all of these new nuances that are part of the game now, including the pitches, how many, you know, now the third time that somebody comes up to hit, he's a better hitter than he was the first and second time. Yeah. So all of those things are entering into these theories right now. And that's what's hurting the pitchers. The pitchers will never pitch nine innings again based upon what we've seen.
Well, in fact, Blake hadn't pitched more than six innings all year.
Right.
Anyway, here's how it sounded. Here's how it sounded at the moment.
We know how it sounded. I'm pissed off, damn it. I want to talk about this.
Listen, we know this is how it sounded. This is what Snell and Cash said afterwards.
Man, talk about a short leash. 73 pitches, two hits, nine strikeouts. Snell can't believe it.
No, I mean, definitely disappointed, upset. You know, I don't know. I just want the ball. I felt good. I did everything I could to, you know, prove my case to stay out there.
Personally, I felt Blake had done his job and then some. Mookie coming around for the third time through. I value that. I totally respect and understand the questions that come with it. Blake gave us every opportunity to win. He was outstanding. They're not easy decisions.
I'll say
not an easy decision. It was the easiest decision ever. Leave him in, you idiot.
Well, that's
what's the matter with you?
You know why, Bob and Denny, you know why you're sounding this way?
Because I'm pissed. I was pissed when I saw Eli. I'm telling you.
I'm telling you, you view it as everyone else does, as an affront to what baseball always was.
Yes.
And is in our brains about what it was meant to be. We grew up and a good starting pitcher. You're right. That's what he's out there for. That's one of the beauties of baseball is a pitcher can pitch nine innings and go all the way and win a game. And yet, so when you throw that out in such an extreme case like that and then see it blow up in your face, there isn't a single person, I think, in America who said, good call, because Mookie's coming up and he's already faced him twice. Now, in defense of Cash, if you're going to defend Cash, and it's very difficult, because he was very
frank. Mrs. Cash didn't defend Cash.
He said Blake couldn't have been better, like he said. He said he put it together in a big way for us. Then he was asked, what more could Snell have possibly done to stay in the game? Cash said, that's a fair question. I don't know if I've got the best answer right now.
There's a great pick on the internet and on Twitter. I think Iffy the Dopester posted one of Denny sitting in a dugout with Sandy Koufax when they were young and in their prime in spring training. And when Blake Snell struck out nine guys through four innings, he tied the great Koufax's all-time World Series record. And folks, Eli and Denny and I obviously saw Sandy Koufax a bunch. If you're younger and you never did, this kid, the way he was pitching the other night and the way he looked reminded me of Sandy Koufax.
Oh, he was that good the other night. I'm going to tell you, he pitched one of the best games I've seen in a long time, but we'll never know how he was going to wind up. And, you know, maybe Cash is right. I doubt it. But when you got a guy out there that's given up two lousy little singles, not walked anybody, done exactly what he was supposed to do, you have to give him every opportunity. Cash said he gave him every opportunity to win the game. He did not. If he stays in the game, then he's got every opportunity to win the game.
Now, I think
did you, Denny, hear what Smoltz had said earlier? It was kind of a foreshadowing of this when he said, you know, I don't know how long they're going to go with the kid tonight. Let's see. But if he comes out, it won't be because he's physically tired. It's because he'll be mentally tired. Mentally tired. If guys were mentally tired, especially at his age, nobody ever in your generation would have pitched a complete game.
He was totally locked in. He was mentally totally on board. But here's the other thing. Cash brings in Nick Anderson, who had a 7.20 ERA in seven postseason appearances, only five strikeouts and 10 innings for a reliever. And
he'd given up at least one run in his last five outings.
So afterwards, he was asked, did he feel like this was the best version of himself? He said, definitely no. A lot of workload. You know, he said, crazy, honestly, how tired he was. And yet, this is baseball, Denny. He would never tell management or his manager that he felt tired, that he may not have been in his best, because people don't talk about that. So that if Nick Anderson had been lights out, fine. But now he's to take out a guy pitching one of the greatest starts in a clutch game in history. And then he brings in the guy who's been bombed recently. Bombed. And in the next six pitches, the game was over.
It made no sense. No sense at all. He's got all those pitchers sitting down there in the bullpen. And he brings this guy in who hasn't got anybody out since Matilda was a baby girl. And lo and behold, we turn around and now we're down 3-1 in an inning or two.
I don't want to beat this to death. I don't think we should. But I thought of three names.
I'd fire him. The hell with him.
I'd fire him.
I said that too. That guy probably cost them a World Series. What's he going to say to the owner? I would have two. And three names came to mind, fellas. One, Fred Merkel. Two, Bill Buckner. Three, Don Denkinger. And now we have Kevin Cash.
Yeah. So you got players, umpires, and now managers guilty. And Cash is considered the best young manager in baseball. And to see this happen to him.
Well, he blew that reputation.
Yeah. Did you see what A-Rod said? A-Rod said on the postgame show, he said, I'm sick and tired of seeing these Ivy League guys coming in here and messing with the game. Essentially.
Interesting. Well, the Ivy League guys are the general managers also, but
yeah. Well, what did you think about the other controversy, of course, is what happened at the post game with Justin Turner being suddenly pulled from the lineup. And everybody's saying, why would they take Turner out? Well, and of course, we found out later why they did. So go ahead. Who wants to go first? Talk about Justin Turner.
The league is going to investigate it. But, you know, hopefully he turns up negative with the next test. But here's the thing. You know, he went on the field and he had to take his mask off to take the picture. He was also infected in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh innings when he played. So really, he'd been exposed to everybody. Is it that big? I know it's protocol, but is it that big a difference? I don't know. And he's sitting right next to Dave Roberts, who's ancient, at least compared to the players, and is in the so-called vulnerable group, and he couldn't give a damn the fact that he was next to Justin Turner. He was thrilled to be out there. So,
but Eli, I thought this was such a simple thing. So for whatever reason, they get the test back in the second inning during the game, and they tell Turner, and they get, so we got to take you out. I mean, just
did they tell him?
We just got the test back. Put a mask on. Put a mask on now. Play with the mask. Leave it on.
Did they tell him in the second or third inning that he had?
They pulled him from the game.
I thought it was later on in the game.
They found out in the second inning, they said they got the test back.
No, they got an inconclusive test back in the second inning.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, they pulled him out immediately.
But the thing about it is we know how this disease is transmitted, and it's like it's a mouth-to-mouth thing, okay? So he knew that he's positive for COVID. He's not going to die. He's going to be fine. But there he is on the field afterwards, and he kisses his wife on the lips.
Well, that's okay.
Knowing that he's COVID-19
positive.
Please,
he kisses her every night anyway. It doesn't matter. That doesn't
bother
me at all.
You know what I'm saying. He shouldn't have done that.
He should probably not. But, you know, everybody else wanted him out there,
Listen, he was irresponsible.
Put a mask on.
He knew the rules. He knew the protocol. He knew everything that was going on with the disease. And the bottom line is he was irresponsible. And he was negligent, period. No more needs to be said. That's what he was. He didn't care at that point in time who he was going to pass, touch, kiss, hug. I mean, he hugged 20 players while I was watching the damn postgame.
Well, but he had hugged him the night before and the night before them in the clubhouse. Whatever.
Maybe he didn't have it the night before.
I think it's also worth noting that all the Dodgers tested negative and have been able to fly home. So no harm, no foul, because they didn't get it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Overall,
and even if they had gotten it, Brandon, again, these are young athletes. Most of them are not going to have any symptoms. Turner doesn't have any symptoms. They're going to be fine. But don't take a chance if you know you're positive.
Okay.
You can go on and do your business. Put a mask on. That's all.
We get it. I'm pleased overall that the Tigers won. Pardon me, the Tigers. The Dodgers won.
Boy, you are it today. What year is that going to be? 2029?
Have another drink.
I said one word wrong. Does that make me out of it? Because I said Tigers instead of Dodgers. That makes me out of it? The hell? I'm glad the Dodgers won. They were screwed in 17 with the Astros cheated. The Red Sox probably cheated in 18. They've won 8 straight division titles. Been in the World Series 3 of the last 4. Good for them. Glad to see they're back there. By the way, did you see the video that was produced and obviously produced beforehand that Gibby voiced over about the Dodgers and all that? If you saw that or not, where they played that on.
No, I didn't see that. No,
I didn't see it either.
And what's interesting is that their last championship was in 88. And all you see when they talk about the 88 team is Gibby's home run. It was his only at bat of the World Series. And Oral Hershiser was the World Series MVP. What's interesting I find about this is that, tell me if this was public knowledge or not, Gibby went out to interview for the Dodger job that Roberts got, and Gibby did not get the job. He had just contracted Parkinson's then, and he didn't get the job. I don't know whether that played in the decision or not, but Roberts got the job, and so I just saw a lot of irony sitting there. But anyway, can we move on from that?
I got one more thing for you, and it's a very important thing. There's a website called Sportico. It's a business website. And they, in an exclusive interview with baseball commissioner Rob Manfred just this past Monday, Manfred said that 30 clubs amassed an unprecedented $8.3 billion of debt from their various lenders. They'll post a $2.8 billion to $3 billion operating loss this year. The Dodgers supposedly lost $125 million in this bastardized season. And we know why the debts were accrued, because they went ahead and decided to play it. Now, you can see Manfred says this is probably going to affect teams' ability to spend for free agents. That sounds like another excuse for collusion to me. I mean, how much money does this really mean to the owners? But you have to think about this. They're not going to lose this dough again. So the speculation among a lot of people is that unless we do get some kind of drug to combat COVID, baseball's not going to, they're not going to go ahead with another season. They're not going to be any baseball in 2021 unless something changes. And right now, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, there would be this again, but I think it'd go on for years. We don't know.
That's the point. There wouldn't be this again, Eli, because they're not willing to lose this much money again in a 60-game season.
Yes, they are.
Well, how do you know they are?
You know why I know they are? because otherwise they would lose billions more. The fact that they won 140 million, lost 140 million, they're wiping their brows in relief. The reason they went through this, so they get the TV money. Otherwise, they would have lost massively more amounts of money. So, of course, they will play the season with the same desperation they played this season. We don't know how it'll turn out, but don't think they're going to save money.
I don't know, Denny. What do you think about that?
They lose, well, Bob, they lose money by not playing. There is no question about that, and much more than by playing.
I think I told you this earlier. I got a good friend at the ball club, and bottom line is what he said was they were already, that was about 2 months ago, they were already sitting down in a conference room at the ballpark, and they were talking about a 60-game schedule again next year. They put a budget together for 60 games. So anything is possible in the near future, and it's something good or something bad is going to happen in the next couple of months. Watch.
I would guess they would plan a 162-game season, and they'll play as many as they can, or they may plan a 100-game season, and if the vaccine comes,
I don't think it'll be 162.
Anyway, I want to tell you that with social distancing, which the Dodgers didn't exhibit last night, you don't need your reading glasses to see somebody 6 feet away, but you still can't see your phone without them, and that's why so many people, 45 and plus, who have lost their close vision, everybody 45 plus loses their close vision, they get multifocal lens implants that enable you to see the tiniest print, also see perfectly at a distance, a life-changing, lifetime-lasting procedure. And, of course, you get that from Dr. Yaldo, who has done more of these procedures than anyone in Michigan, especially when that comes to LASIK, which people under 45 get. Custom LASIK, he has the most precise in the world. All these surgeries are the safest with the fewest side effects in all of medicine. So get a free evaluation. Doesn't cost a penny. Find out which procedure could change your life in ways you can only imagine. You call 1-800-398-EYES. Tell them No Filter sent you, and you will save $1,500 off the regular price. You can also sign up at YaldoEyeCenter.com. And everybody in Michigan knows Lincoln's legacy of luxury cars. Buying a Lincoln at Hoot McInerney Star Lincoln, you'll find both the buying and service elements to be hassle-free all the way. It's why Lincoln is Michigan's premier Lincoln dealership, an exemplary family business started by Hoot, the legendary auto giant and philanthropist. They get 5-star reviews like crazy. People who are so pleased with the service and the quality that they get with Lincoln and Star Lincoln. Drive the Star of American Auto Luxury. Call Star Lincoln for an appointment at 248-354-4900 or buy effortlessly online at starlincoln.com. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Well, before we get into Big Ten football, and there's a lot to say about that, since we have Todd Stottlemyre coming on later, who was the son, obviously. By the way, Todd Stottlemyre won 138 big league games. Danny McClain won 131 big league games. I'm not comparing the two right-handers. Don't get me wrong. But I thought for a second you won the exact same amount of games, and actually he played 15 years. Denny, though, we should note, won 108 of them in a five-year span, which is one of the fastest to 100 victories in baseball history. But anyway,
let's get to the key number here. Can we get to the key number here now that you've been through all that? The key number is this, 24.5. 24.5. I saw the point spread on the Michigan. Michigan's a 24.5 point favorite. How humiliating. How humiliating for Michigan State. And what's going to be a controlled scrimmage Saturday in Ann Arbor with no fans. Oh, my God.
Before we get to that, and that's fine, I was going to talk more about the baseball, but that's
okay. Well, whatever.
No, obviously,
we never know where we're going.
Obviously, since I'm the one who's out of it today, you're the one who changes subjects. Well, we're not ready to change subjects, but what else is new? What else is new? Yeah, anyway, before you get into Michigan and Michigan State,
this is such a big deal usually. Go ahead.
Can I please say
yes?
How the Big Ten could not get through 1 week
without
coronavirus.
I know.
Schedule, and now Wisconsin can't play its upcoming game against Nebraska. It may not be able to play the game after that, too. This incredible red shirt freshman, Graham Mertz, starts with a record-setting performance, and now he can't play maybe for 21 days. By the way, he was amazing. 20 of 21 versus Illinois, including 17 pass attempts in a row. So Wisconsin goes from this, where they're saying, what a great season is going to be, to who knows now.
Yeah.
And Mertz is out there as the day one starter. And he's going for the end zone again. And it's caught again by Jake Ferguson. His second touchdown of the first half. And what a start for Graham Mertz. He's still perfect on the evening.
Not only that, but his backup, Chase Wolf, is also out for 21 days. And I don't know if Jack Cohn, the senior they beat out, had foot surgery. So what does this do to to the balance of power right away. Wisconsin, which is number, I think
they're number nine this week. And the other number right there, Eli, that you mentioned is the number 21. I mean, every place else. Well, you got to sit out. You got to quarantine for 10 days. 21 days. Why? It's ridiculous. So at this point, you look at it and say the Big Ten either should have been like the SEC. They should have said, "Okay, we're going to play," or they should have said, "We're not going to play." The way they're doing it now is just so stupid. It's ridiculous.
Well, I'm not sure if it's stupid. I think at the time when they were making all these plans to do exactly this, sit out these guys for 21 days, they were just trying to protect the players. Now, with saying that, I also want to point out that they're getting better at treating the COVID. They're getting better. I mean, there's fewer and fewer people dying lately. So something good has happened here. They're treating it better. And let's hope that it just continues in the direction. But that's the reason why the Big Ten guys all agreed that they would put everybody in quarantine for 21 days.
I know that. And that's ridiculous, as I said.
I understand. But if they saw what was coming now, what's happening a little bit now.
Yes.
That people are being managed better. I think they would have had some kind of an option.
But wait a minute. That's nice of you to say. And pardon me, forgive the sarcasm, but we're rounding the corner on Corona. There's only a few hot spots.
I heard that quote somewhere from somebody.
There's only a few hot spots. Of course, only a few hot spots between Florida and California and 50 states, northeast, west, and south.
Oh, and by the way.
Besides those 50 states, there is no problem with Corona.
And by the way, Germany and France have effectively shut their nations down this
fire.
Week. So we ain't rounding no corner. How screwed up is everything? How screwed up is everything?
We come here trying to pretend it's just sports and we can forget about it all. Listen, it's a one topic world. There is no subject, whether it's finance, whether it's housing, whether it's political, whether it's sports, no matter what it is, COVID affects everything. And so sports is not free from it, as we know. And of course, Michigan's going to play Michigan State on Saturday.
Unless six guys come down Friday as we tape this Thursday morning. Yeah. I don't know. And it'd be a great blessing for Michigan State and Mel Tucker if they did cancel that game at the last minute.
If the game with Wisconsin and Nebraska is also canceled on 11/7, which is the following week, even if it isn't, what are they going to do for a quarterback? They're down to their fourth string guy who's some freshman nobody's ever heard of.
I really don't know. I don't know. And then of course, Michigan is coming off that 44-10 win last year.
Yeah.
The home field advantage doesn't matter. The Free Press headline story this week, though, said, for Michigan, rivalry with MSU has become another game, quote. It's kind of like more Michigan arrogance, isn't it? Sorry, Eli. Along the line of Mike Hart's infamous, it's like beating your little brother.
Who said that? Just because a writer said that,
that's the headline of the article, you know. So I don't know. The question is, how's Mel Tucker and the Michigan State players, how are they going to respond after they laid such a gigantic, embarrassing egg against Rutgers? How much pride do they have?
To me, there's two questions here. Number one, is Michigan that good or is State that bad? And my second question is, which team was worse? I hate to say, change the topic here, the Spartans or the broadcast team of Millen and Byington? What an awful way to welcome Big Ten football back into our state. Poor Matt Millen. I don't know what has happened to him. I know he had.
Well, he was really sick. He almost died.
Was the heart transplant? No, it was.
I think something. Yeah, some kind of big transplant. Brandon, maybe you can find that for us.
No, I know what it is. I'm trying to find it here. I had it written down. He had something that threatened his heart. He had a heart transplant in December of 2018, and it just seems like he can't get through a sentence anymore. It's affected his brain, and those two together were just awful.
He doesn't have AFib, does he?
No. Where the hell? He had a rare illness that required him to get a heart transplant. It was a protein deficit in his heart, boy. A rare disease. But I tell you, so this Jaden Reed. He's the transfer from Western Michigan.
Right.
First poor kid. First play of the game. He catches a nice pass from Rocky Lombardi,
drops it.
And so over the course of the game, so he catches the pass, gets it stripped. Later, he's called for a blindside block. Later, he takes his eyes off the ball and drops it, a miserable miss. And later on, he has the ball yanked out after a catch, all in the first half. But otherwise, he did okay.
He had big numbers. He put up big numbers, but they were behind. They had to throw.
Oh, by the way, so I'll give you a chance to listen to this broadcast team in case you missed it. The Millen Byington team on Jaden Reed's big play of the day.
Lombardi connects to Reed.
That's
going to
be
six. Here comes Reed. Reed with the big gain, and he's in for the Michigan State touchdown.
They got outnumbered, Lise.
Lise.
Was that a woman?
That was a woman.
I told you, Denny, last week that Lisa Byington was going to. Oh, and by the way, our own boy, we're very proud of him. He was on our show. Gus Johnson going to be doing the game this Saturday. I saw that on that 506 website. Yeah. But, you know, here's a more pragmatic problem that Mel Tucker now has. There are high school teammates in New Jersey, one of whom is Audric. I'm not sure how he pronounces his last name. Estime, I guess it is. He's a 3 or 4 star running back, depending upon the service you use. He's from Montvale in northern Jersey, which Eli knows, an area Eli knows well. So Michigan State had recruited him away from Greg Schiano. And the kid's got a teammate also at St. Joseph Regional High, an offensive lineman named Gino Vandemark. Right after Saturday, I'm telling you, the Rutgers coaches were on the phone with these kids. You don't want to go to Michigan State. Why, you stay home and play for us in Jersey. You stay home because we're going to win. You saw what we did in Michigan. So they're trying to get these. They're trying to flip these kids. I wouldn't be surprised if they did. So there could be plenty of trouble ahead. Remember, my fellow Greenies, though, no matter how ugly and awful it gets, this is just a game on Saturday, isn't it?
Is this true? Are you telling us something that's truthful, or did you hear?
No, I lie all the time on the show.
No, I'm not accusing you of lying. I mean, as creative as you can be, I'm not accusing you of lying right now. Just tell me, is this something you heard or read or what?
I have sources there, obviously, number one.
That's fine.
Back in that area.
Nice to tell us. Yeah.
And I think I did see an article about this, that they're trying to flip this guy. But with that, I mean, look, this happens all the time.
It's football. It's college free agency. There's free agency.
Yeah, exactly. But the only reason I mention it is because of what happened when a Rutgers team that had lost 21 straight conference games goes into East Lansing and beats Michigan State. I mean, well, look, enough said about that. And I'll tell you what, when we get to Monday, there might not be a lot to say about Saturday's game either, because I think Michigan is just going to kill them.
I do, too. And I'm really glad that you changed the name of the conference, Bob. That was really, really getting old.
The Big 13 plus Michigan State football from now on.
Maybe we can just go back. Maybe we can go back to calling it the Big 10, maybe. What do you think? Is there a chance of that? You're not going to call it the Big 13 plus Michigan State from now on, are you?
I might.
Okay.
You know what they say? There's nothing more saintly than a reformed whore. There's no bigger Michigan fan than a Walmart Wolverine. And did you see this thing last week? In California, they sentenced one Daniel Rippey to 1 year and 1 day in prison because this guy had made threats in 2018 to harm Ohio State football players because they're beating up on Michigan. The judge, in handing down the sentence, epitomized this as, quote, fandom spiraling out of control. And, of course, the city just apologized and so on and so forth. But can you imagine? I mean, you know, what can I say? And naturally, he had no connection to the University of Michigan other than being a fan.
Well, Michigan as a team looked very good. Of course, it's only 1 week. They beat Michigan State by a combined.
I interject for a moment?
Yes, sir. You're a Walmart Wolverine, too. I know you're going to defend yourself, right? And your ilk.
Okay, number one, that's the snootiest thing anybody can ever possibly say. I'm serious. That's such a bad take. The Walmart Wolverine.
See, because it's
so you didn't go to
a school.
You
know about snootiness.
Why don't you let him finish? Why don't you let him finish, Bob?
Number
one, finish what he's saying.
I don't know where you got this thing where you've been saying that I'm a Michigan fan for a year and a half now.
And you are.
Why am I a Michigan fan?
Why don't you let him finish, Bob? Why don't you let him finish?
I have no idea where that came from. I didn't go to the school. I don't act like I love the school. I don't wear their regalia or their merchandise. Secondly, if you didn't go to a school, and you like watching them or you're a fan of their team, then we need to make fun of you and call you a Walmart Wolverine because you're a loser and you didn't go there. I mean, there's another guy in this town in Detroit who does that, but it's a Mike Valeni thing, and it's also a terrible, terrible take. Terrible take. I would say your favorite football team is the New York Giants. You talk about them all the time, but you're from Michigan, so you just, you know.
Well, that's not a relevant analogy.
Oh, okay. So you're a Walmart Giants fan then. I mean, it's just.
No, I'm not. I cover the
Brandon,
New York Giants.
Brandon, are you implying that Bob Page occasionally insults people?
That's just, that's all it is. It's an insult.
And comes off in an arrogant way. I don't know where you get that from.
And I just, I hate hearing that all over here. We hear it so much here in Michigan. It just really looks down on people who become fans of a team because they didn't go to the school.
The implication is this. I'll explain to you and your arrogant friend who did go to Michigan working on this program right now. The implication is that there's something missing in your life. There's something lacking. So you need to win, win, win.
Oh,
you need to
God.
Feel good about yourself. So you root for Michigan. But God forbid if Harbaugh and Michigan ever do go belly up because the rats are going to be deserting
like
the ship
who,
real quickly.
Yeah.
Let's all generalize about everybody. Let's put them in one big box.
To me, that sounds like somebody who grew up in Michigan, so they should be a Lions fan. But then
I was a Michigan fan. Okay.
And then they moved to New York and become a Giants fan because they win championships.
This sounds like some drunken brawl.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Well, I've never seen Brandon so animated.
You're going to start throwing French fries at each other.
I apologize. I'll edit some of this.
It's okay.
No, you don't have to apologize. I don't want you to edit it. No,
don't edit it. So meanwhile, Michigan does look very, very good. And they even had a big backer or someone who approved and was very impressed named Urban Meyer. Here's what he had to say after rewatching the Michigan game the other day.
I thought Gattis did a heck of a job. That's a legitimate spread offense. And he has options. He wasn't a real aggressive runner, really good runner. I think he's just going to get better. He is a giant athlete now. And the offensive line for replacing four of the five starters really played well. So I was, you know, I thought this was going to be one of those down-to-the-wire games. They dominated A to Z on that in that one.
They did. 49 points, and they missed three field goals. So we'll see. They're 25-point favorites at home.
Yeah, unbelievable. But I must say, though, there is potentially good news for Michigan State football. USA Today took a look this week at the 673 bowl games college football foolishly now has. They predicted that Michigan State's going to get a bowl bid. They said they're going to play West Virginia.
Why not? In
the Guaranteed Rate Bowl in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And yes, my peeps tell me that the NCAA will allow teams with zero or one total victories to accept bowl bids, which Michigan State's going to wind up with.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, folks, I want to tell you once again, we always do, about a great guy who can really, really help you. Luke Nowacki of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. What he's going to help you with is planning for future family obligations and your own retirement. His track record of success and decades of experience is going to enable Luke to create a custom solution for you or your business. So you just give him a call, 248-663-4748, and he's going to meet with you for free. You can Zoom like we do on this show or whatever you want. Luke is going to lay out a plan for your financial needs, and if you feel comfortable with it, let him do his thing. He's ethical. He's knowledgeable. He's caring. Luke Nowacki, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. Again, that number to call is 248-663-4748, and advisory services are offered through Royal Alliance Associates. And with rates at record lows, there isn't a better time now to redo your mortgage if you've got one. You want to call David Hall Mortgage to get the best deal around. He's served the Detroit metro community for more than 30 years by consistently offering better options and more personal attention. In the process, he's built a resume of thousands of satisfied clients. David Hall Financial proudly provides the fastest service in the business as well, generally three or fewer weeks, and that's enabled them to garner nearly 1,500 five-star reviews from Michigan homeowners just like you. So you go to DavidHallMortgage.com to get started. Phone number couldn't be easier to remember, 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, and more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
I was saying earlier, because we got Todd Stottlemyre coming up, whose father, Mel, pitched against Denny many, many times. And I'm thinking, because I got on my wall, my Mickey Mantle day. I drove in from Long Island. I didn't drive in because I was only 15 in 1965 on September 18th when the Yankees hosted the Tigers. The Yankees were on the beginning of their decline. Stottlemyre came up at the end of 64 when they went to the World Series and pitched in the World Series. By 65, they were already going downhill. And the biggest crowd of the season was on September 18th. They made it Mickey Mantle day, which was years before they had another Mickey Mantle day when he actually retired, but they were trying to get fans there, and I was one of them. And I remember Denny pitched that day, but Denny, I looked up the box score. You won, Tigers won 4-3-10 before 52,000 people, but Sparma started the game, and you came in relief. You had three innings of perfect relief, no runs, no hits, one walk, four strikeouts. You won the game because it was our Tigers were trailing 3-2. You only relieved four times that year. Why would that happen? You were a starting pitcher. You won 16 games, and yet you came in and pitched three innings.
That was 1965.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. No, that's, I just broken into the rotation, so. You know, Charlie had this thing. You pitched on your, in other words, you pitched on Monday, Wednesday you threw, and Friday you pitched again. That's what Charlie's whole system was all about. You pitch and you pitch and you pitch, but you also take a day off. Where Johnny Sane was, you throw every day, every day, every day, every day, and it keeps you sharper. And Johnny proved it.
You had 29 starts, just four relief appearances, but that one of them was that day. So I don't know.
That's funny. I don't recall that at all.
Yeah. Well, you don't recall much. It's all kind of a blur to you, isn't it?
Well, I was going to answer the question for him with a stock Thank Denny McClain response. I don't remember. And I got some stuff, by the way, later on in the program.
Nasty.
I did some.
This is not nasty.
What is this, Denny time?
I did some research, by the way, on Denny McClain versus Mel Stottlemyre, which we'll use when Todd comes on later on. And I know I'm going to get a lot of I don't remembers in that segment as well.
Denny, I said one word wrong in the beginning, and he said, what's wrong with you today? You know, like I'm off.
Well, you're sensitive,
jumped
too,
all over your eardrums, isn't he?
I'm very sensitive. I'm extremely sensitive.
Yeah. Hey, how about the FLs in Indianapolis? Is this like a must game coming up on Sunday?
When do you stop calling the FL? If they go to 7-3, are they still the FLs?
No, I haven't decided.
Okay.
Years of habit.
They're underdogs against Indy, but you know, it's very interesting because these next few games are very, very winnable for them. They got this, although Indy, but if they get by Indy, they got Minnesota, who's awful, Washington's very mediocre, Carolina, Houston, they could, who are a combined 7-20.
You're right.
They could win some games. And you mentioned that in the last show, Denny, by the way, that they got a nice schedule. After that, though, it gets very, very difficult. Then they play teams that are like 20-5 from there on in, including, which is the Bears, who beat. Then they got the Packers, the Titans, and Brady and the Tampa Bay Bucks come here at 12-27. And I'm telling you, that is my favorite football story of the year. I was never a big Tom Brady fan, liked him, respected him, but I, you know, they gave him three Super Bowls. The Tuck rule was one. The other one was when Bevel made that ridiculous call against Seattle. It's another Super Bowl that he was given. And then Atlanta choked it away. Not to knock Brady. He still won all those games, but I was never, you know, like the leader of the fan club, but you know what? I'm in it now. And good. I love Bruce Arians. I said he is a great coach. And look what he's doing. He plucks AB. He gets Gronk. He's got Brady. This is a really great story. And I'm excited by it.
By the way, Arians went out of his way to point out that it was his deal. Tom had nothing to do with signing this guy, bringing him on board. Mm-hmm. And Arians took credit for the entire thing.
And Denny, I don't know if you saw this. He also said that the first practice, for what that's worth, he said AB was amazing. He looked fantastic.
Yep,
the first
said day. He was fantastic.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. I want to mention this just because I saw it today. And do you realize that the Lions haven't fumbled this year? And I'm not talking about losing a fumble. I'm talking about just putting the ball on the ground. Really? It's the first time in the history of the National Football League that a team has not fumbled once in its first six games.
Hmm. Really?
Also interesting, Sunday's clash for first place in the AFC North. So it's the Steelers' Mike Tomlin and the Ravens' John Harbaugh. They will become the first pair of head coaches in the Super Bowl era to face off 25 times against each other in the regular season. And Denny, you were talking about this before we started recording the show today, so I'll let you have it, but I'll get you through the name. Tua Tagovailoa here in South Florida makes his first NFL start with the Rams, the opponent.
Yep.
And I Ascension think, in the Dolphins locker room too.
He's quite an athlete. The video that I've seen on him, four or five pieces of video I've seen, this kid can do it all. And he can throw the ball 90 yards, for God's sakes. So get ready for a kid that
controversial.
Let's keep him healthy.
Well, he better be able to do that because Eli played that audio cut of veteran quarterback Jeff Fitzpatrick recently talking about how disappointed he was.
You mean Ryan Fitzpatrick.
I'm sorry. Just to have his job taken away from him the way it happened in Miami, and a lot of other Miami Dolphins were just as disappointed. So you've got some dissension in that locker room. How about the worst mismatch of the week? The pathetic 0-7 Jets at Kansas City. But this one has an interesting twist. How about this? Ex-Michigan State star Le'Veon Bell makes his Kansas City debut against his former team he just left after ripping them to shreds. And fellas, you talk about a garbage game. Normally, it's something I wouldn't even deign to watch it. And I'm not a gambler, as you know. But with COVID, there's nothing else to do. So, yes, I'm going to watch 1-6 Atlanta versus 3-4 Carolina on Thursday night. How about you?
I don't. I think maybe that'll be a night for Chicago PD. Doesn't sound like a football game I want to see.
What's going on with the Bears, by the way?
You know what? I'm not. You know, I can get on and off a bus pretty quick, and I'm off.
And you're
I'm
off now.
Foles bus. Who is Foles? We're going to trade him to somebody.
Bob, back off your mic! My God,
I can't believe how bad he's been. When he's been bad, he's been horrible. I mean, he's not even, you know, like in that yellow area. He's not in that yellow area. He's in the red area. God, he threw over seven or eight passes over their heads, and most of these guys are wide open. So I don't know. The Bears still have one of the best defenses in the world, but you just can't play in the NFL all year long and expect to win with only a defense. That's impossible.
Listen, the team, the bad team that fascinates me most are the Cowboys. And this and this week, Michael Irvin said they may be the worst team in the NFL. He says the Jets haven't won a game, but would you take the Cowboys over the Jets right now? What's going on with that defense? And you know, these are things that Jerry Jones does a show every week, and he kind of blew up at the one of the radio hosts.
Yeah, he told somebody to shut up, didn't he?
Yeah, because he asked about leadership. He just shut up and let me answer the question. But you know, here's what it made me think. Jerry Jones is the polar opposite in terms of an owner than what we've had in Detroit. And I really like Bill Ford. He wasn't a great owner, but he was
very nice man.
Old money is right. He'd stand there after the game, very polite. Whether they won or they lost, he called you by your name. Yep. He'd sit there with that cigarette, you know, and the throat that would have been, you know, pounded by nicotine for 60 years, and he would talk to you, and you couldn't not like him as a person, a nice, respectful man who blew no airs. Of course, Jerry Jones is the exact opposite, you know, thrives in the notoriety, craves the attention, you know, came in and he fired Tom Landry the day he bought the team, the legendary coach, and he won Super Bowls. So he challenged the NFL. I forget it was Coke over Pepsi or Pepsi over Coke. He totally defied the league's soft drink provider, built the great stadium. Would we have rather had an owner like that in this?
Yeah, you know what he needs to do, Eli? Jerry Jones needs to fire his general manager. That'll solve all the problems. Or he's himself? The general manager. I mean, Jerry Jones is one of these guys. It's like when Bill Davidson, you remember, came in and bought the Pistons with his group. He looked around at guys like Ozzie Feldman and said, we are successful, very bright businessmen. We're multimillionaires. There's nothing to this sports stuff. And he found out he was wrong, which is why he brought, as we know, Jack McCloskey and the rest is basketball history. But that was Jerry Jones. I mean, he came in thinking, hey, I played football at Arkansas, you know, with Jimmy Johnson. There's nothing to this. I'm a self-made multimillionaire. There's a lot to it, Jerry.
He fired Tex Schramm. He made the deal for Herschel Walker, got 15 draft picks, and built the Super Bowl champion in 2 or 3 years and 2 in a row, as a matter of fact, and used that pick to draft Troy Aikman. So Jerry Jones came in. Now, of course, teams have ups and downs. The guy is a genius in his own way, and he built a great team. He built the best stadium. That's the envy of everybody. All I'm saying is that, and I'm sure he's, I don't agree with him on a lot of other things, but I just thought of it. He's a polar opposite owner of William Clay Ford and the Ford family.
Yeah.
And not as nice, but more effective.
I'm glad you brought that up. I want to say that I looked from afar in New York after I left in 1988 and stopped covering the Lions. And I did like Bill Ford. And it actually hurt me as the years went on to see him isolated, sitting up in his booth, And he just wasn't the same man. He almost looked like a broken man because of the constant losing all the time. And about Jerry Jones, I found myself walking out of the press box in the Meadowlands right after a Giants-Dallas game, right after he bought that team with him. I said, oh, you're Jerry Jones, the new owner. Introduced myself all the way to the elevator and down to the locker rooms. Doesn't say much for his intelligence, but he picked my brains, asking me what I thought about this, what I thought. So this is a guy who came in wanting to learn, wanting to know. And you're totally right. He's brilliant, but he's not a likable guy. And I don't think too many people are pissed that Dallas is losing right now.
One thing about it, he did it his way, totally his way. And the only way is his way. So you got to respect him for at least that, being
absolutely
the bright guy out there. And he's done some great things. Look at the stadium he built. I mean, no one would ever think you'd spend $2 billion on a football stadium. And I mean, although he uses it for lots of different kind of venues, but boy, I tell you, he's a genius when it comes to marketing. He really is.
By the way, we got to say goodbye to our radio audience in Toledo, WCWA. You have been listening down there, and thank you for listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Simple yes or no to either of you. Are the Cowboys like Notre Dame, either love them or you hate them?
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. That was my other question.
Always. All right.
And by the way, you missed the ultimate example right there, Eli, like the New York Yankees.
Oh, yeah, that's true, too. Yeah.
Hey, Feldman Automotive
is
Michigan's number one Chevy dealer. 5 locations, Novi, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, Highland. Feldman has 9 locations in all. It's rather the biggest auto dealer in the state. Feldman Hyundai of New Hudson, Feldman Key of Novi, Feldman Dodge, Jeep, and Ram of Woodhaven. And, of course, Michigan's number one pre-owned supercenter in Waterford, known simply as 1-800-PRE-OWNED. Buy a fully inspected and guaranteed pre-owned auto from Feldman. You relax with their exclusive Drive It for 3 days. Love it. Or bring it back. It's a guarantee, and you also get guaranteed credit approval. You can find what you're looking for in any one of Feldman's 9 locations. Massive inventory, unmatched in Metro Detroit. Buy online at FeldmanAuto.com with an effortless, hassle-free experience. And Power Home Solar, America's fastest-growing solar energy company. Own your own power. It's based right here in Metro Detroit. Every one of their state-of-the-art panels made in America. You get solar energy from Power Home, where you save money, help save the environment, and never again suffer those costly power outages, because, as we've told you, they have in-home backup battery from generator systems from Generac, the number one company in its field in America, too. Lower your energy bills, eliminate power outages for good. Financing starting at $99 a month. Call them at 1-800-POWER-90 and get a $2,000 cash back on your purchase. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Didn't have to say that again, but I did just for the hell of it.
Interesting NBA note, the Houston Rockets are going to hire Mavericks assistant Steven Silas to become their next head coach, replacing the man I refer to as Roll It Out Mike. And I know that a lot of you older basketball fans remember Paul Silas very well, his dad, great rebounder and a great guy. I remember talking to Paul about Detroit native Derek Coleman when Paul was head coach of the then New Jersey Nets. Derek played for him. And I asked him, how come Derek always seemed like he was such an underachiever? Paul shrugged and he said, I just call him Derek. I don't give a bleep Coleman. I said, you call him that to his face? He said, yep, I do. Didn't seem to motivate him then either. And how about this? The NBA is now targeting a start date for the new season. The old one just finished around Christmas, because Adam Silver does not want to miss out on that big Christmas money with the 5 games back-to-back they have. And they want to play a 72-game schedule, likely to be played in home markets with no fans in attendance. So that puts the start of NBA training camp about December 1st, less than 2 months after the Lakers just wrapped up their title run. And there is already talk from his teammates, the LeBron James, and we'll go for it. Danny Green said the other day, I think most guys, if they said we're going to start in December, I think they're like, I'm not playing. I'm not going to be there. I wouldn't expect to see LeBron James probably for the first month of the season, end quote. How
and
about that,
to
fellas?
Show you that they don't follow each other, the Super Bowl this year is going to allow 20% capacity for the Super Bowl. So,
yeah, 20%.
Got some guys shutting down, some guys opening up. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, but the point is, what if Adam Silver says we're starting the season and the players say, no, we ain't?
Well, I don't know.
Or they start the season and LeBron says, well, you guys start the season. I'll see you in a month. That's when I feel like joining the team.
Why? Because he's tired? Is that what you're saying? He wants a longer offseason?
Yeah, because, yeah, sure. They want more of an offseason. Mm. That's the whole point right here. It is a battle. And again, Adam, so they want to play Christmas Day, as they always
they
do.
Will,
you know,
they,
you know how you cure that, right?
Go ahead.
you cure it by giving them more money. That's all they'll do. Give them
They don't need any more money.
The NFL. Well,
listen, they'll take it.
Forget it. Stop. The NBA players and owners have the best arrangement, the best trust of anyone. And just because one player says that, let's not take it as gospel, and that's going to happen. Okay, when the NBA
one player happens to be LeBron James,
it doesn't matter. When the NBA decides to start the season, they'll start the season, and the Players Association will agree. They all want to make money. They got
absolutely.
So, bottom line. Okay, at this day in sports, I remember this. I'll be a little personal here. 1962, Y.A. Tittle threw for 7 touchdown passes against the Redskins. I think that might still be the record for touchdown passes in a game. Interesting. On this day in 76, Billy Martin named AL manager. And this day in 79, Dick Howser replaced Billy Martin as Yankee manager. I don't know how many times Billy was Yankee manager, but that was one time. This
as
day
bad, 19- as bad, Eli, as bad a guy as Billy Martin was, Dick Howser was a great guy.
Yeah.
Interviewed Dick Howser, one of the nicest men I ever met in baseball. What a tragedy. He died so young. I think brain cancer, wasn't it?
Yeah. That
was Y.A. Tittle, when I was growing up, a young child, I thought the word tittle was a dirty word.
You mentioned Howser and Quisenberry.
You're not supposed to say that word.
Yeah. Howser and Quisenberry both died of
yes. And there's another prince of a guy, Dan Quisenberry. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Let's see. And this day in 1931, a Lefty Grove won 31 games.
Another bad guy. Everybody always said Lefty Grove was one of the worst people baseball ever had, but that was a long, long time ago. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know, so you shouldn't have brought it up.
I had one
know.
Conversation with him.
You did? You met Lefty Grove?
Yeah, I met Lefty Grove. And he certainly was not a bad man that day. We were there. We were in Cooperstown for the induction. And lo and behold, he was there. He was a good friend of my father-in-law's, which I did not know. In fact, I knew very little about Lefty Grove when I met him, but he was an enchanting guy, and he stood there and talked to us for an hour, hour and a half. So it was
one of the all-time greats.
And a memorable introduction it was. It really was.
You know, seriously, Bob, you know, and I don't blame you for doing this because we all hear things, but when one person says somebody's a bad guy and it happened 50 years ago, you know, labeling them as a bad guy is kind of
you think it was just one person who said that?
I think it's irrelevant at this point. All I'm doing is mentioning that he won 31 games.
Yeah, we're just trying to kibitz around. We're just trying to kibitz around your little
On this day in 1960, Cassius Clay had his first pro fight. He beat Tunney Hunsaker on points in 6 rounds in Louisville. Years later, I'll tell a little personal story. I met Muhammad Ali, and he was already starting to become a little addled by the Parkinson's syndrome. I said to him, I bet I know more about your career than you do. And he goes, okay, try me. I go, who was your first fight against? He had no idea. I said, you beat Tunney Hunsaker in Louisville. And I named 4 or 5 others. And the most amazing thing I saw was Alvin Blue Lewis was a Detroit boxer.
Yeah.
Fought Ali in 1971 when he was on the comeback trail after Frazier beat him. And years later, Ali was in town and I was there. And Blue Lewis fights through a crowd to get to Ali, who didn't remember him. And Blue Lewis was crestfallen. And I said to myself, how can you have a guy in front of your face that you're punching for 10 rounds and not remember who he was when you see him again? Anyway, there was that. The Rumble in the Jungle was also on this day where he KO'd George Foreman in the 8th round. So
brief mailbag now. Not a lot this week. And we want to get to Todd Stottlemyre. You can tweet us, or tweet me at least, at Bob Page Sports. And Bernie Fratto did so. Now, I don't know him, and I think a lot of you people do, the longtime Detroit sportscaster.
Yeah.
Sure. He's doing his thing and apparently doing really well in Vegas right now. On the last show we had with Larry Sorensen subbing for Eli, Bernie wrote, great stuff. Sheboygan, the Philippines, the nuances of MLB, the game inside the game. And a good points by Larry. Pitchers should throw from the stretch with a runner on third. Why would you give a free, huge secondary lead? I still believe the bunt is a terrific weapon. As Augie Garrido, the famous college baseball coach, used to say, you're going to make 27 outs, make one or two productive. Pressure the defense. Power comes and goes, but a well-placed bunt can rattle the defense and start a rally. And Larry is also right about staying inside the ball as a hitter going the other way, using the whole field as something that is emphasized and employed by smart hitters. Robbie in Arizona wanted to mention, I really appreciate Larry Sorensen mentioning Bill Fundero on the show Monday. He was a fixture at the ballpark, and I think you guys know by now, the longtime usher just died this past week. He says, I have a soft spot for all those old-time employees and ushers at Tiger Stadium. Took really good care of me. We are going to miss him. And then Jimmy Lyons is back. Say,
I agree. Billy Fundero, I heard you talking about him.
Okay.
Great guy, one of the ubiquitous figures at Tiger Stadium. And when you go there a lot, you meet all these guys, and it seems like a thankless job, but they are so happy. They're so thrilled to be a part of the whole ball team. But yeah, Billy, you're a good guy.
Yeah. Website submissions, asknofilter@gmail.com is how you contact us. And Jimmy Elias is back. Don't think we've heard from him. Another week, another enjoyable listen. Bob, I want to address your newfound excitement you seem to have for the Detroit Lions. You seem to have a jump in your step after their latest win against Atlanta. And so are you drinking Kool-Aid? Of course. And this is the key point. Jimmy says, I'm sure most of us won't admit it, but when your home team shows any sort of hope, a ray of hope, people's attitudes change. As Eli has said before, this is the beauty of sports. Sure, we can all say we're Lions free, but are we ever truly free? Well, that's interesting. I mean, I can't say I really want the Lions to win or anything like that. I'm still so angry over the fact that the Ford family, Bill Ford, Russ Thomas people stole my football team. But that's interesting. That's interesting. And don't forget, you can also call us or text us at 760-89-BALLS. And the ever-popular unnamed texter closes this segment by saying, Danny, if they told you on October 10th, 1968, in the eighth inning, that you had to stay in the clubhouse, quarantine, and not celebrate with your teammates following the final out, would you have listened to them? Would you have pulled a Justin Turner and raced
out? And he didn't follow rules? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's right. Rules were for somebody else. Right. And funny thing about
it, listen, it took me an hour to open up the damn bottle of champagne. You think I'm going to not be a part of that?
But, you know, on a more serious note, that seems like a flip question. It actually isn't. I have yet to talk to one person who was a sentient being as we were in 68, who remembers that year we had a flu epidemic that killed 100,000 Americans.
And wonder.
Yeah, and you wonder, you know, I mean, you know, if we'd known what we know now, how the baseball season in 68 might have changed. And, of course, we held Woodstock in 69 and how that might have changed.
I mean, look at 68 with the riots, with the murders of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, with the riots at the Democratic National Convention, with the Vietnam War, with the Hong Kong flu. Man.
Every week
it was a new headline. Freshman year, I had a great time. Yeah, I had a great time that year.
Every week was a new headline.
Yeah. Well, let's get to our special guest. Todd Stottlemyre pitched 15 years in the major leagues, the first seven with the Blue Jays, with whom he earned World Series rings in 92 and 93. Son of Yankee legend Mel Stottlemyre, also pitched for the A's, Cards, Rangers, and Diamondbacks before he retired in 02. Then became a stock market analyst for Merrill Lynch and later founded a hedge fund. He's also written two books, neither about baseball, the last of which is out now, called The Observer, A Modern Fable of Mastering Your Thoughts and Emotions. But it was pitching that gave Todd Stottlemyre his platform, like this 1996 NLCS win over Hall of Famer Greg Maddux while pitching for the Cardinals.
Couldn't hold up. Strike two on Jones as Stottlemyre looks for a perfect first inning. 1-2. Inning over. A strikeout ends the first, and after one here in Atlanta, Maddux and Stottlemyre. Good pitching again here tonight.
Wow, you know, when you hear some of the names in that game, Chipper Jones, Maddux, Tom Glavine in that game, so many great players, and Todd Stottlemyre joins us now. Good to see you. How are you today? Thanks for being with us.
I'm great. I got to tell you, you know, most people that do shows that go back to my career, it's never strike three, you're out. It's always something else. So, hey, man, you guys, you're number one in my book right now.
Trust me, we're going to get to the
One, period, damn it.
We're going to get to
on this show.
We're going to get to the blood.
A good start. So.
We're going to get to the bloody chins and kiss my ass later on. So just
Of course. Of course.
Anyway, where I want to start is in looking at your life story, one event in your life that really shaped your life after that, both as a baseball player and what you do now, is you lost your brother to leukemia when he was 15. You gave him a bone marrow transplant that put him in a coma, and quite understandably had a real profound effect on your life. You've said you were an angry animal that lived inside of you. Elaborate for us what that was like and what it's like to get over that and to move on with your life and become the success you became.
Man, I got goosebumps. You know, it really did change my life. It changed the direction of my life. It changed the direction of who I became. And it also changed by being who I became. I also had to fix that. I would tell you that on 1981, it was my little brother's third bout with leukemia. And inside this third bout, that the doctors claimed that his only chance to live a life was through a bone marrow transplant. Now think about it, it's back in 1981. And so everyone in the family, you know, they tested their blood, and I was the perfect match. And I was 15 years old at the time. And I gave my little brother the bone marrow transplant, and it seemed to work great. He was running around the hospital after the transplant. Doctors were even talking about, you know, being able to go home and putting him on a program to come back every, you know, month or whatever it was going to be. And 2 days before the release, that they were going to release him from the hospital, he went into a coma, never came out of it, and then died. And 2 days later, and I remember looking at him, you know, laying in his bed as he's taken, has right after he'd taken his last breath. And I had this overwhelming, of course, sadness. I just lost my little brother. My mom and dad had just lost their youngest son. And it was a tragic moment. But I also had two other emotions that were on top of that sadness. And number one was hate. I hated the world. I was so mad that, and I hated God. And I was like, how can you take my little brother from me? It's not fair. He's only 11. And then I had the guilt, and I was like, wow, my marrow just killed my little brother. And I buried those two emotions, hate and guilt, inside of me. I buried them. And it was 1993. It was actually, we just finished winning the second world championship. If you looked at me from the outside, 28, making millions of dollars, living out my childhood dream, playing Major League Baseball, man, you'd say, man, this guy's got it all. But the problem for me was I looked in the mirror. I couldn't stand the person looking back at me. I hated myself. And I was still carrying. See, I didn't like my reactions, my responses to anything in life. I was out of control. I was a ticking time bomb. And then I, you know, I reached out to a guy who was known as the mindset guru in Major League Baseball, and that would turn careers around. This guy's name was Harvey Dorfman. He wrote The Mental Game of Baseball. I reached out to Harvey. He'd worked with Hall of Fame. He worked with so many guys, and especially pitchers. And I said, Harvey, this is Todd Stottlemyre. And he says, I've been waiting on you. And he knew my whole story. And I said, I need to get the guy. I said, I need help. I can't stand. I said, I'm tired of living this way. I'm also tired of performing. I was like, I'm so much better than how I'm performing. I can't stand that I'm allowing emotional outbreaks to control games. And I went and met with Harvey. I got to tell you something. It was life-changing for me. It was also the beginning of this book, The Observer, because Harvey asked me, we met, we spent 12 hours together in a hotel room. Here's what he asked me, first question. He says, would you do it again? And I said, do what? He said, would you give that bone marrow transplant to your little brother? He says, and this was 12 years later. He said, would you do that again? I said, Harvey, I'd do it every minute. I do it every second, every minute, every hour, every day, he goes, if you would do it all over again, then I need you to let that go, because you've already laid your life and your body down to try to help. And he goes, look, it wasn't, you couldn't save him and you also didn't kill him. So it's time for you to come to grips and let it go. And I broke out in tears, man. It was so hard for him, but it was like this animal just was released out of me. And then he said something. He said, but if you would have said no, because that could have been the answer, I wouldn't do that again. He said, if you would have said no, he said, then I would have told you to change today to honor that defeat. And I was like blown away. We'd spent 12 hours. In the last hour, he did something else that changed my life. He put me on a 7-day challenge. And he said, Todd, he said, every thought you have and every reaction, every emotion you have to a challenge in the next 7 days, you're not allowed to respond. You're only allowed to document. And I was like, okay. He said, so if you got this response, and he goes, all I want you to do is observe the way you think and the way you feel and document it. You're not allowed to respond for 7 days. You got to promise me no responses. I said, deal. And that was the beginning of The Observer, because that was the beginning of life change. You see, The Observer lives between stimulus and response. See, my problem was I would get stimulated and I would respond with hate and guilt from 1981. And because I never healed it, I carried that baggage and those anchors along with me forever. So I had to observe my thoughts and my emotions, but I wasn't allowed. All I could do is document it. And by document it, you start to learn more about yourself. Because here's what I knew. Based on how I was responding on the mound and reacting to situations on the pitcher's mound, but more importantly in life, the way I was responding and reacting in life, what was happening was I was end up having sleepless nights. See, because I didn't like it. And what Harvey was teaching me was how to become the observer of the way I was thinking, become the observer of how I was feeling. Because here's what he said. If you don't like what you're thinking and you don't like what you're feeling, as a human being, we have the opportunity to change the state of our thinking and emotions anytime we want. It becomes a choice. Now our reaction is something that we choose instead of just emotion.
You know, the shame of it, Todd, and by the way, you don't know this, but both Denny and I lost our daughters at young ages. And what happened to you, they didn't have the knowledge maybe back in 1981. You weren't allowed or shown how to grieve properly because, like you said, you didn't cause it, you couldn't control it, and you couldn't cure it. You were an observer, to use your word, who was a participant in trying to help him. And if that had been explained to you as a 15-year-old saying you did the courageous thing and the right thing, you would have been brought through that, and it would have saved you a lot of pain and agony over the next 15 years for sure. But let's and I want to let the other guys in. I'm kind of hogging here, but I want to, before we get through this, I want to talk about your anger, because before game four in 1993, the Jays are up 2-1. He had this feud because the mayor of Philadelphia, after the second game, said, I'd like to bat against Todd Stottlemyre. And you went into this mental war and you made an interesting base running decision. Let's listen to that and we'll talk about it. Go ahead, Brandon. All right.
Stottlemyre around second, and he'll try for third after hesitating. Stalker's relay out at third.
This is the most aggressive base running by an inexperienced base runner that you will ever see.
I know your father talked to you about that. Was that all part of it? What made you a player? Because I mean, it was a decision that you would have made maybe otherwise, but explain that.
So first of all, you know, anyone that knows baseball, you don't get thrown out at third base. All right. So let's go back. But Tim McCarver called me an inexperienced base runner. Come on, Tim, man. I played the game of baseball. But anyways, listen, I get it. You know, it was a bonehead base runner mistake. But, you know, that was me at that time saying I'll do anything I can to try to win or help the team. And you know, and what happened is, and I did hesitate going around second base. And it wasn't as I hesitated. I was kind of breaking it down. But what came to my mind was Lenny Dykstra doesn't throw well. And I was like, and he's not going to think I'm going to go to third. I'm going to catch him sleeping and then whatever. And then, of course, you know, I didn't catch him sleeping. He caught me, I guess, sleeping. But in any case, that was a bonehead move. But yeah, you know, and that whole feud with the mayor, you know, pitchers, starting pitchers prior to World Series games, it's the only time they ever do pregame interviews. You know, all season, the only time you talk to the media is after a game. Well, in a World Series, you talk to the media before and after the game. And as I went in for my pregame, and I go in with our PR director, Howie Starkman, the media is everywhere and they just start, hey, the mayor said this. The mayor said the Blue Jays must be trying to throw the World Series. They're pitching you. And he's saying the mayor is like, I could even hit this guy. And then I responded. I reacted to that. Right. And I was like, well, tell the mayor, go get a bat, go get a helmet. Let's get this over with. Sure. Make sure he brings his helmet, because the only chance I got of hitting him in the head is if I miss his neck. And by the way, this thing took on a life of its own. And the media went crazy with it. And it went back and forth. And I remember having breakfast with my father before game four. And he said, Todd, they got you. Because I hadn't slept all night. Once again, all of this emotion was now attacked. It was like, and I couldn't let it go. So here's what I would tell you. By the time I got to game four, I was emotionally worn out because I was so busy fighting the mayor. Sure. You know, and this was the part of the issue I had. If I couldn't control something, I wanted to fight it. And I was like, in my responses and my reaction to things. And I would tell you that, you know, it was one of those things. It was a unfortunately, it was a great learning lesson. But, you know, also in that start in 1993, it's like, I think it might be the worst start I had in Major League, my whole Major League career. And it just so happened to be in, you know, one of the biggest games. But, hey, you know, I always say it happens, man. So I
got, and you guys got, won the game 15-14 long after.
Oh, I walked against Green. I remember my plate appearance, you know, I was hitting and I walked, I got down to first base and Crux says, he is so funny. He goes, you're not going to believe this game is going to end up crazy. And I said, what do you mean? He said, it's going to end up like 14, 13, 15, 14. It's like he called it. And I was like, man. And I was like, I sure hope not.
Okay, well, since nobody said
anything. Let's hear from Denny.
I'm sorry.
Denny pitched against your dad so much. Go ahead. Yeah. I know you and Todd got a lot to say to each other because I even went to the internet and picked out several games where you started against Mel and what happened and so on and so forth.
And go ahead, Bob. Tell me about that.
Oh, okay.
You're dying to tell me. Obviously, I didn't win.
I thought you had a question for him. April 14th, 1966. Rookie Mel Stottlemyre goes 7 1/3 against Tenney, but the Tigers win in New York 3-2. Denny the victor, Pedro Ramos off our childhood baseball cards, took the loss and released Mel. And
by the way, Mel was a rookie in 64, but close by.
Oh, sorry about that. I had 66. Now, how about this one? September 19th, 68, in the now legendary game where Denny deliberately gave up that homer to Mickey Mantle. Todd's dad did not fare as well as he had in other games. He went 6 innings, took the loss. He fell to 20-12 for the season. Denny won game number 31. Of course, he went the first full nine. But in Denny's 31-win World Series victory season on August 24th at Yankee Stadium, Mel goes the distance against the Tigers. He outpitches Denny. Imagine all 9 innings these days in a 4-hit, 2-1 victory over Denny, who took the loss and fell to a miserable 25-5.
Okay, enough.
You asked for it.
What
I'm
do you
giving
mean,
it to you.
Enough. What? Do you you can ask a guest. 4-minute question and we can't talk?
That's not a question.
Get him, Denny. Get him. Cut
Jeez,
him off.
I mean to tell you, it's been Denny Day here all day today. It's kicking my ass. Boy.
Throw a beanball.
I tell you. Hey, listen, let me, you know, and I had some great times with your dad. He was a class act. He was a real serious.
Yeah, he sure was.
I say this in more ways than one. He was a real major leaguer. He really was. He was one of those guys that always had time for you. I had numerous conversations with him. We were both trying to pick up sliders from each other. Neither one of us had one that we would call sensational. But we are able to throw strikes with it. Now, those were the things that we tried to match up from time to time. How much credit do you give your dad? You grew up with your dad. How much? My dad died when I was 13, so I didn't have that advantage. But how much time and how many good things did your dad do for you in your career?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Denny, you know that. And by the way, I tip my hat to you, man, because I got goosebumps, man. I get the chance to hang out with you here on this. So,
well, thank you.
Cool for me, man. But, yeah, you know, dad was more than father to us. You know, he was our best friend. He was our coach. He was our mentor. He was our hero. And he was also the guy that, you know, we had the most confidence and trust in. It's like, hey, dad, you know, I got a problem, this and that. And he had an open door policy, man. And it's like, and we were like brothers, but I can't tell you how many times during my career I had to call him and say, you know, what do you think? And I'll never forget in 1992, actually, I was struggling so bad on the mound and I was getting beat up start after start. And you know, you get beat up 2 or 3, 4 times in a row, you start kind of like, man, what is going on? And I lose my mojo and this. And I called dad, I said, and he was a pitching coach of the New York Mets at the time. I said, dad, I'm struggling. He goes, I see that. And he kind of chuckled. I'm going, man, it ain't funny, dad. I can't even get through the 5th inning, man. I said, I'm getting beat. I'm not losing games. I'm getting crushed. And here's what I said to him. I said, dad, I said, I make a good pitch. They're fighting it off to the outfield grass. I make a bad pitch. They're hitting home runs. And here's what he said. He goes, you know, actually, I don't see you making many good pitches. I was like, oh, okay, fair enough. And he says, look, Todd, he says, but I'm going to tell you something. If you'll do these 3 things, you'll dominate. And I said, and I honestly said this to him. Dad, I don't need to dominate. I need to get through the fifth inning and in a hurry. I said, because look, they're going to get rid of me, you know. And he says, trust me, you'll dominate. In between your starts, just do these three things. He goes, stay back, finish strong, think down. He says, you're throwing everything up in the strike zone. He says, you're rushing. Everything is, it's like you're in a hurry. He goes, look, just stay back. And I was like, I can do that. He goes, of course you can do that. You've done that your whole life. Stay back, finish strong, think down. He goes, there's one other thing. And I'm like, oh, of course there is. Here goes. He goes, on the inside of the bill of your cap, he goes, in big bold letters, I want you to write KISS, K-I-S-S. He goes, you know what that stands for? I said, sounds like KISS. He goes, keep it simple, stupid. But then he said, but you know what keep it simple, stupid stands for? And I was like, no. He goes, stay back, finish strong, think down. I went in. That's all I focused on in between starts. I did my bullpen, stay back, finish strong, think down. My next start was in 1992, was in Comiskey Park against the Chicago White Sox. I didn't give up a hit into the eighth. And it's the only hit I gave up to Dan Pascual with a 3-1 count. I won 9-0. I threw a one-hit shutout, and it looked like an overnight success.
Well, why the hell didn't he give me that information?
Yeah, I hear you. But, I mean, and then I went on this tirade because he broke the game down in its simplest form for me, but he did something much more important than that, Denny. He believed in me when I lost belief in myself. He says, man, you can do this. And my dad was, he would find a way to say those words to lend you his belief so that you could then grab and borrow that belief he had in you and then go apply it. And because I trusted him, and because it was my father, it was like, I would take that information and go run with it. So, you know, he was so massive into my career. And you know, he would also call and say, well, you threw up again. And he had this saying, if you throw up, you got to sleep in it. I said, yeah, Dad, I messed up. He says, well, did you sleep in it? I said, yeah, I slept in it. And what the meaning was, are you taking responsibility for that? You know, and my father was big. It's like, you know, the old sayings, if you're going to dance, you know, you got to pay the fiddler. If you're going to hoot with the owls, you got to soar with the eagles and all the sayings. But what it really came down to is whatever you say and whatever you do, you got to own it. If you will own it, then it'll become.
Yeah. So Todd, what's it like? What was it like for you and your brother growing up, the son of a very famous Major League Baseball player? Were you under a lot of pressure to also be good? Were kids jealous of you? Did they try harder? Did kids suck up to you because they wanted to curry favor? What was that all about?
Probably all those things. You know, it was my mother and father. You know, you can't pick your parents, but man, I sure ended up with great parents. But you know, they helped us along the way. My father used to say, listen, I don't really care what you guys do. He says, just give it everything you've got. Just be the best you can. And he goes, if you're going to dig ditches, be great at it. If you're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, be great at it. If you're going to be whatever, be great at it. If you choose baseball, just work hard at it. Have fun and work hard at it. And you know, my father worked overtime on saying, don't try to be me, be you. And he would always focus on be the best that you can be your authentic self. Now in Little League games, you know, you would hear the buzzes and, you know, you'd always be like, you know, and all the games going through. And if we did well, they'd be like, well, of course they did well. Look who their father is. If we didn't do well and didn't have a good game, then the words would look like this. Wow. Look who their father is. Like, what happened to them? Now, I would tell you, when my mom would hear that, she would go irate, right? Because sometimes they would say, maybe they got that from their mother. And she would go, mom was the general. Let me tell you something. She would go irate, like, you know, in any case. But, you know, that was part of the deal. That was, and by the way, we just kind of like accepted that was part of the deal. The other thing, too, is growing up, you know, we didn't realize at the time, running around Yankee Stadium, I remember standing in the outfield grass with Mickey Mantle. I remember hanging out with Yogi. I remember, you know, Bobby Mercer's, the Thurman Munson's, you know, all these names and greats and legends and people, you know, like Denny. It's like we just knew him as family friends and my father's teammates. We didn't know him as these big stars, right? We were kind of like not in that game. And I collected baseball cards and we played street ball games in New Jersey just like everyone else. But we didn't look at it as, oh, my dad. And, you know, Yankee Stadium was our, it was a playground, Monument Park. You know what Monument Park was to us as a kid?
Yeah.
It was monkey bars. It was our monkey bars. We just ran around the stadium. It was just a part of it. And I'm grateful. And you know, the game was different back then. We could hang out in the clubhouse and we play tape ball games with the other kids in the clubhouse while the dads are out playing the game. During BP, we're running around the field. I have my Yankee uniform on every day. That was just a part of it. We didn't look at it as, look at us, we got something special. We didn't we didn't realize how special it truly was. And not until later on, until I became a player, when I looked back, and then I said, wow, look how special those times really were.
Credit to your father, because he had the misfortune of being in one of the worst eras of Yankee baseball. His rookie year was 64, their last championship. And then after that, they finished 10th, they finished 9th, they finished, you know, 5th several years. So that was a credit to Melly. It's such a great career playing on Yankee teams that really, really weren't that great. We talked about you learning the things that you learned and learning about your anger and coming to terms with it. In 2000, you won the Lou Gehrig Award, given to a player best exhibits the character integrity of Lou Gehrig, and the Branch Rickey Award in recognition of community service. What were you doing back? And I ask you to pat yourself on the back. What were you doing back then? Obviously, you had a transformation because you went from me to maybe helping people. Was that part of your transition? And why did you get those awards?
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, those two awards, that Branch Rickey Award and that Lou Gehrig, the Lou Gehrig Award, you know, because he was a Yankee, you know, and it was like, man, this is like, I was so taken back by it. You know, I was.
Were you doing charity work? What were you doing?
I was serving the communities that I played in. You know, I gave a lot of money away to United Way out here in Arizona. When I signed that big contract, I was like, wow, you know, I got so overpaid. I go, let me use some of this money to serve. And I wanted it to go to United Way, and I wanted to go to Children's Foundations because of my little brother. I'd done some stuff with the Leukemia Society of America. I used to run a golf tournament all the time. And I was just doing everything I could to give back and to serve to less fortunate, because I felt like, man, I'm being so overpaid. I'm so fortunate. I'm living my childhood dream. I got all of this blessing. I'm like, I should pass this blessing on to other people and less fortunate people. And then I, you know, I got this. I'll never forget the Branch Rickey Award. It was the funniest thing for me is I go to Colorado to give my speech. They introduce me. They hand me the award. Goose Gossage actually was the guy that introduced me and brought me up on the stage. And that was cool for me. Another Yankee, right. Another Warrior. And, you know, a guy that was connected to our family. And I get up there and they had all of these like pictures of all the previous winners. And they were all Hall of Famers. And I looked over there and I said, guys, this must be a serious mistake. Either that or this year's award is a charity case, because everyone on that freaking wall is a Hall of Famer. I said, how are you going to put me on that wall with all those guys? But jokingly, I said that. But I got to tell you, it meant a lot to me. Sure. It meant that I was being recognized for being more than a baseball player. I was being recognized. And I felt like that recognition was kind of like, Todd, you've turned the corner. You know, you're not an asshole. You're not a bad guy. You're not whatever. And this and that. And you're doing the right things. And it was cool for me. You know, I have both those awards. Matter of fact, the Branch Rickey
Award. Oh, yeah.
Right. We're on
the
Zoom.
I don't know. You probably can't see
it. Yeah, we got it. We got it. Of course, the audience can't hear it.
Those awards are special to me. And you know, I keep them here in my office and with all of my stuff and this and that. But it's like, they are special because of what they meant to me. You know,
can I buy one of them?
No.
Who's going to ask Todd the question? Blake Snell, fill in the
blank.
Yeah,
was, yeah, and openers and how pitching has changed, which we talk about with Denny all the time and Larry Sorensen when he's on the show.
Could you believe it? What the hell happened to Cash? Did he have a brain fart?
Listen, the computer's got to him.
Yes,
you know,
sir.
I hate to be that guy, but I'm just going to say that, you know, baseball has lost its personality because of the computers.
Yep. Yes.
Baseball, listen, computers, analytics is a great tool, by the way. And think about it. We've looked at charts our whole life. We've looked at analysis and this and that. And what we've done is we've taken that analysis and we've tried to formalize game plans to our strength and against hitters' weaknesses. We've been looking at analytics forever. It's not new to the game.
Right.
What's new to the game is analytics are now running the game instead of being a tool inside the game. And that's where analytics are a problem. See, analytics will never measure the heart of the Warrior. Never. And I'll tell you, you know, when you look, by the way, it wasn't just the Snell game. Don't forget, in the Yankee series, a guy they paid $300 million to, they took, and he was throwing a one or two hit shutout, and they took him out after a long fly ball out. You just took the guy that was supposed to bring you the next world champ. You just took him out of the game. I'm like, what? I don't even understand what is going on. Now, look, I'll tell you, I wasn't like Denny. I wasn't like my father. I didn't complete all these games. But I will tell you this, man. If I was going good and you came to the mound to try to take me out, I would want to fight you, man. Matter of fact, Buck Showalter came out to get me out of a game in 1999. I took the ball and put it in my back pocket. I said, I'm not giving it to you, so see you later.
I did the same thing.
You know, I mean, like, I'm not going to do
it. Did Buck fine you for that?
No, he appreciated it. He was like, listen, if I'm building a baseball team today, I want all of my starting pitchers, I want them to want to fight me to come out of a game, not hand me the ball and say, oh, I gave you a good five innings. Five innings. That's like working a 40-hour week. What are you going to do the other 128 hours? Screw off?
Unbelievable.
You know, I mean, it's like, but I'm going to tell you something. It's a problem because, and here's what's going to happen someday, in my opinion, is they're going to say, man, what happened to starting pitchers? And they're going to be complaining. They're creating the mess. Analytics, computers, taking guys, and this 100 pitch rule. I've never seen anything like it. Listen, once again, I wasn't like Denny. I wasn't like my father, but I'm like, and if I didn't throw 125 to 140 pitches in the game, I didn't really pitch.
You were talking earlier that the Jack Morris threw 126 pitches when they beat the Braves in that seventh game. Were they going to pull Jack out in the fifth inning, sixth inning? Crazy.
Listen, hardly. You go try to take Jack Morris out of a game where he's
your teammate, right?
All I got to tell you is good luck.
Tell us a little bit about the book. You've already mentioned The Observer. I know it just came out. I guess you talked about it a little bit earlier.
Must do a lot of motivational speaking too.
Yeah, I do. And I go around and I've been blessed and fortunate, you know, companies will invite me in and this and that, and I'll go speak, but you know, and I always tell them, I don't want to motivate you because it'll be gone tomorrow. And if you don't get motivated tomorrow, then this is worthless. Let me give you some tools. And you know, the coolest thing about my baseball career is I can reflect on the habits, the routines, and the rituals of what it takes and what you got to go through, and then go and take those routines, rituals, habits, mindsets, all of those things that help teams win games and sports, and then go share them with corporate America and say, you can apply the same process to your teams and the vision of your company. So let me give you tools that you can go try instead of just try to get you all hyped up for the next 24 hours. So I try to say, my whole theory is, I try to make an impact. And I try to make an impact by reflecting. And that's what my book, this book, The Observer, is. This book, The Observer, is the mess I had to work through. And here's what I would tell you. is like, if you're today, if you're a, if in, and look at our world, how hateful we've become, right? And if you look at the all the hate, it's like, hey, if hate is driving your life, then you need to read this book because hate drove my life. Hey, if guilt or baggage or past circumstances today are affecting your present moment, then you better go read this book because that was also me. See, the observer was my mess. It's become my message because I found a way to overcome it with the help of people. See, I didn't do it by myself. I had teams, I had people, I had mentors, I had my father, I had Cetil Gaston, I had the Dennis Eckersleys, the Ricky Hendersons, I had Hall of Fame teammates that I got to learn from. I had people like Denny I could watch as a kid and try to understand what's going on. I had a front row seat. It was like going to a school of champions. And I've taken the reflection of all of that and provided it in principles and models in a book to try to help people. And it's looking, if you might be saying to yourself, Todd, that's great, man, but I don't need help. Listen, if you're that person, I would tell you, you've died on your feet because you've stopped growing. That's also a problem. See, think about it. Denny will tell you too. Up until his last game in Major League Baseball, he was always trying to get better. He was trying to get an edge. He was trying to figure something out. Right. That's what you do in athletics. But what happens today in real life? You know, someone becomes a millionaire. They think they've solved the world's problem. They become God's gift to the earth. No, the second you believe you've arrived, you've died on your feet. And the observer is about continuing to pursue and find ways to get better.
Love yourself and not hate.
It's not out. It's in pre-order. Okay.
By the way, so let's we have one more soundbite. This is the old 27 years ago, the former life of the angry Todd Stottlemyre to the group at the Sky Dome after the World Series when he had fought with Ed Rendle, the mayor of Philadelphia. Here's what he said to the packed crowd.
I got one message for the mayor of Philly, and I hope you're out there looking. You can kiss my
hey, you know,
all lifetime ago,
I called
right?
my father after that. He said, "Well, son, you did it again." And I said, "Yep." And I said, "Dad, I own it." And I wasn't smart enough to realize that parade was being broadcast around the world live.
Well, you can
as they say, a billion red Chinese didn't give a damn.
That's right. You can order the book. I pre-order it if you want. The Observer, a Modern Fable on Mastering Your Thoughts and Emotions. Hey, Todd, great talking to you. Good luck with the book. Appreciate all the motivation. I feel spiritually uplifted, and it's going to last 24 hours.
I'm ready to go.
Because I'm going to get the book. Thanks for joining us, man.
I just want to say I'm humbled, man. I'm honored. I'm humbled. I appreciate all of you. You know, keep up the great work and everything. And you know, along with the book, I launched a free book club on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, come. And what I'm going to do inside that Facebook group is there's 37 chapters over 37 weeks. I'm going to talk about how each chapter influenced my life. Good. And not only how it influenced my life, but who are the people that helped me overcome that challenge. So there's a lot of lessons from my father in that book. There's lessons from Cetil Gaston, Tony La Russa. There's lessons from my baseball career. There's lessons from growing up. There's lessons from Yogi, and I can go on and on. And I've inbred those all through this Modern Fable. But come join that book club. It's totally free. I'm just going to hang out with people all through 2021. And you can go to Todd Official. And you can go order your book anywhere you want. But you can come to Todd Official, and that's my website, and click on the link. And if you pre-order the book, I would say, hey, man, that's great. I appreciate it. I'm humbled. Even if you don't order the book, you can come be a part of the book club, man. It's on Facebook. It's free. It's like we're going to hang out all year next year. Roman.
Great talking to you. Thanks,
Todd. Thanks, Todd.
Thanks, Todd. Have a good one. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks for reaching out.
Have a good day, man.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, he was terrific. And you know what? You never know what you're going to get. I was just on Twitter, like, this is 3 weeks ago, and he tweeted something. I don't know why it fell to me, because I don't follow him, or he me, obviously. And I thought, you know what? He might be a good guest for the show. So we went back and forth with 20 emails about trying to do this. Good. I didn't know what to expect. He was great.
Me too. In fact, I'm thinking, do we really want Todd? Are our fans going to be able to, our listeners really appreciate it? I remember, you know, as he pitched for the big leagues.
Well, Mel gives him the headline, right?
Well, but the fascinating thing is when you, it takes research to be a good reporter.
Yes.
Research to do a good show, and you do the research and see, there's a lot more to talk about this guy than strikes and balls. So, right. Turned out great. I'm glad you followed up on it, Bob. And, let's see Monday's show. Denny can't be there. We'll have Fred Heumann fill in, and let's get Steve Smith, the former Michigan total offense leader, to talk about what happens this Saturday.
And then I got a confirmation a week from today. We're going to have Mike Hemrick, the legendary, perhaps the greatest announcer in the history of hockey, who's out with a new book himself. So it'll be fun to talk to Doc. What a guy he is.
Have a great weekend, everybody. See you Monday.
Thank you.
Stay safe, everybody. Thank you.